the University of Ottawa, and I'm also a visiting PhD student at the National Research Council of Canada. But today I'll be talking about some work that I started when I was visiting Pierre Donancey, who's a staff scientist at the Argonne National Laboratory. Okay, so when we first started this project, the question that we asked is if we had some electron traveling through material, and that electron would be represented by a qubit state, which would come from the valley, so it would be valleytronics. If we had a two-state system, could we take one of the components of that state and have the current go one direction, so through the top, and then the other component of our quantum state go through the bottom? So if you can imagine a scenario where we have a photon which has some quantum information in it, and we shine that photon on a material, we excite an electron inside that material. That electron would then have a qubit quantum state associated with that. And then we can actually guide one of the components into one channel and the other component to the other channel, so we can effectively design a quantum transducer. So you can imagine if we had an ensemble of these structures, all with the same photon going into them and creating the same quantum information traveling through this device, we could then measure the coefficients afterwards and basically get all of the information for our quantum state at the end. So we can actually measure the coefficients, and then we go from photon to electron to digital information, and we can then use that digital information somehow. Okay, but then the next natural question that you would have is, you know, what do you do in the middle of this device to actually separate the valley currents in a two-dimensional structure? And before you can answer that, you first have to ask, you know, how do we calculate currents in these devices to begin with? And to answer that question, you have to consider what type of transport is going on. So there's two regimes of transport that you can look at. So there's diffusive transport, where the electron's kind of traveling through slowly, and it's maybe running into another electron, or it's running into an impurity in the crystal, and it's slowly making its way as it scatters through the device. And usually in this case, the length of the device will be greater than the Fermi wavelength, the mean free path, or the phase relaxation length of that material. But in another case called ballistic transport, we actually have coherent transport through the device. So it's not scattering off anything, and it's just traveling directly through the device. So if the length of our device is actually less than these three length scales, then we get ballistic transport through our device, and it's completely coherent. So then how do we calculate currents for ballistic transport? And the answer to that question is quite simple. We approach it as electron transmitting through a barrier. So you can imagine an electron going towards this barrier with some current I in, and then we basically need to calculate the transmission coefficient for this barrier, and that will tell us the amount of current that's going out. So if you can remember back to your quantum mechanics class, when we look at a finite barrier problem, we have three areas that we're interested in. So on the left and right-hand side, we'd have propagating waves towards the barrier, and they'd be represented by these complex exponentials. And then in the middle, we have our decaying exponentials. And what we do is we match at the boundaries. We match our wave function at the boundary to come up with a solution and essentially find the relationship between those coefficients in all three regimes. In this case, and when we do that, we end up with what are called transfer matrices. And if we want to calculate the transmission using transfer matrices, we can just multiply them together for the two cases here, and then we just look for the T11 component to find our transmission function for this particular case. And so you can use a transfer matrix. In addition to that, you can also use a scattering matrix. So in the transfer matrix, it relates basically waves from the left and right-hand side, but in the scattering matrix formalism, you're relating waves that are going in to the waves that are going out of your device, and that's essentially what we want to calculate when we want to calculate currents in two-dimensional devices. Okay, so I have to talk about materials because we're looking at devices, so we can't really talk about free particles traveling towards barriers. So the way that we represent the wave function in our calculations is through the tight binding approximation. And the way that we do this, so if we have some one-dimensional material here, then the way we represent our wave function is we put orbitals on each site, and then we want to solve for the coefficients of our wave function given those orbitals. And the way that we do this is we take our Hamiltonian, We set up our time-independent Schrodinger equation, then we take the complex conjugate of our atomic orbitals, and we generate what's called the Hamiltonian matrix, which I show on the bottom left here, and then the overlap matrix on the bottom right. And in the type binding approximation, in our Hamiltonian matrix, we only have the diagonal and then the off-diagonal terms for a rectangular lattice, which I call H to be the diagonal terms, and then we get minus T if I equals plus or minus 1, or J plus or minus 1, so that's the nearest neighbor approximation. And then for the overlap matrix, I assume that the wave functions that I have are orthogonal to one another, so we just get an identity matrix. So that's cool. We can do that on 1D, but what about 2D? So we essentially get these one-dimensional Hamiltonians along the diagonal once again. But instead of looking for numbers now in our coefficients, we have columns of coefficients that we're solving for on the right-hand side. And then these T matrices are essentially the interactions between each of the columns in our material. So this is what it would look like setting up a tight binding for a two-dimensional square lattice. So then to solve this, we need to introduce boundary conditions, and this is exactly how we're going to compute currents, by introducing these boundary conditions. So I'm going to introduce what are called leads. So these blue structures here are leads, and on the left-hand side that extends to minus infinity in the x direction, and on the right-hand side that extends to positive infinity, and these have translational symmetry, so if you look at the time-independent Schrodinger equation, for one of those columns in the leads, what we say is one row will be C, and then the next row over will be C times a lambda factor, and that lambda factor is just a block factor. And then the next one over from that would be C lambda squared, and what that allows us to do is set up a quadratic eigenvalue problem, which we can then linearize by just choosing zeta equals C lambda, and then we end up with this generalized eigenvalue problem here. So the eigenvectors that we get are the modes of our leads, and which I've labeled as V, and because this is a non-Hermitian matrix that we're dealing with, we get leads that are not orthogonal to one another, so it's customary to define dual vectors, which allows you to define a projector, which I call gamma here, which has the lambda factors in it, and that gamma factor basically takes you from column to column. And then the eigenvalues of this system I label as lambda, so those are the block factors there, and you can have real and complex values of pseudo-momentum in this case. Okay, so now that we have that, we can tack on those boundary conditions. So at the top left and top right of our Hamiltonian matrix, we have that projector, that gamma operator, multiplied by with the interaction potential. And then on the right-hand side, we then get a source vector. So this is basically where we're injecting electrons in our system. So the C naught, comma right arrow, those are modes that are propagating towards the device from the left lead. So we basically, all of the modes that are propagating towards our device, we're going to insert one of them one at a time, and then solve this linear set of equations. And once we solve for the coefficients for the finite system in the middle, so the green part of the system, we can then take the coefficients for the last row there that I've highlighted, and then we say that will be a linear combination of the modes in the right. And that essentially allows us to define our transmission coefficients, T of k. And we can basically take the dual vectors of the modes in the right lead, project that onto our wave function to find the transmission coefficients. And when we do this, for every right-moving mode in the left lead and right-moving mode in the right lead, we get our transmission function. And once we have our transmission function, we can then calculate the current by multiplying that by the differences in the Fermi-Dirac function between the left and the right leads. So the only reason we're getting current in the first case is because we have a difference in chemical potential between the leads, and then we integrate over all energy to calculate the current in our system. All right, so everything I just said is already programmed for you in a package called Quant. So if you're interested in doing electron transport calculations, this is definitely the package that you want to check out. So this allows you to construct those Hamiltonians for different types of lattices and actually calculate the transmission function in a few lines of code, and it's really well documented, so it's really easy to use. There's a relatively large community with a good mailing list that covers a lot of problems. And apparently they quote that it's faster than other codes written in Fortran and C or C++. And the best part of all, it's free and open source. So if you're interested in taking a look at doing transport calculations, I highly recommend it. Okay, so in my case, the two-dimensional material that we're looking at is graphene. So in a graphene nanoribbon, the leads will have a dispersion relation that looks something like this here, where we have valleys in the conduction band that we label as K or K prime. So when I calculate the modes, I can actually look at the pseudomomentum for those modes. And if the pseudomomentum is less than zero, then I'm going to label that as K prime. And if it's greater than zero, then I'm going to label it as K. And that allows me to actually calculate the valley currents separately for those modes. So I can do that quite easily using the quant Python package. And then again, the Hamiltonian matrix will also change a little bit because we have a hexagonal structure rather than a square lattice now. Okay, now that I can actually do the calculations for the valley currents, we still have the question, how do you design this device so that we can split those valley currents properly in a graphene nanoribbon? So this is the structure that we kind of took. And there was some recent work that suggested that you can basically valley filter and you can have a valley valve in graphene separating the valley currents. And what they suggested is actually applying a gate voltage across it, which is essentially just P or N doping different sites in that crystal. So if you go through and you have to pick a site and then say whether it's P or N dope, if there's 4,000 orbitals that you have, then you have a design space that's 2 to the 4,000 if you're gonna either do P or N doping on every site. So it's a massive search space that we have to figure out how to travel around it to find optimal structures. Okay, so the first strategy that we tried was essentially drawing polygons that look something like this here. So we would select 6 points, and then I would draw a convex hull based on those 6 points. And if I'm in that convex hull, then I'm going to say that's an N-doped region, and otherwise it'll be a P-doped region. And the points that I have here, the X1, Y1, X2, Y2, those will be the genes for a GA, which I'll then try and optimize using a genetic algorithm. So you can imagine here that I have, an ensemble of structures, and each have their own polygons that have been drawn in the device, and those polygons are represented by these points. And for each of these devices, I then calculate the valley currents. And then once I have that, I need to define an objective function. The objective function that I have here, so it has three components. So the first component would be the purity of K prime current going into the top channel, or the lead one that I've labeled here. The second term is the purity of K current going into lead two. And then the last term is just maximizing the amount of currents that are going through lead one and lead two for K prime and K current respectively. Okay, so once we have our objective function, the strategy for optimizing these structures is essentially we're gonna order them by their objective function, where the greater the value, the higher you are on that list. And what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna take the top 25% of those structures, I'm gonna keep those around, and then for the rest of the 75% of the population, I'm gonna randomly mutate them. And the way that I'm gonna mutate them is essentially take the points that I had before and add on a little bit of random noise, so that these U terms here are just random numbers that are between -1 and 1. And then I'm gonna multiply a factor of alpha, which is just a small parameter, to mutate the points in the structures to find an optimal structure. Okay, so after that, we can look at exactly what happens in the optimization process. So I have a very quick movie, so it's kind of sped through because it was the movie is only 30 seconds long, which covers the total process. But you can see it quickly finds an optimal structure given the certain conditions. And on the left-hand side, I plot the objective function as a function of generation. In the middle, I'm showing the purities of the K and K prime current. And on the right-hand side, I'm just showing the currents. So we can see that it relatively quickly converges to a somewhat optimal value. And we actually reach over 90% purity using this strategy for both K and K prime. But you can see here that it's actually optimizing K prime more than K. So we kind of get stuck in this local minima where we're optimizing one rather. Okay, here we go. So good. So we're optimizing one rather than the other. In addition to that, the currents are actually really low for this strategy. So the next strategy that we came up with is more sophisticated, and this is what we called an ANN policy. So if I again consider the structure here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to select one of those atoms, which I've highlighted in blue here, and then I'm going to look at its local environment, which I've highlighted in yellow. So we look at the nearest neighbors and the next nearest neighbors. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a feature vector, which will contain their on-site energy for that environment. I'm going to feed that feature vector into an artificial neural network, and that will give me probabilities that will tell me whether or not it'll be P or N dope. And then I'm going to generate a random number and decide whether I'm going to add P doping or N doping to that site. Then I'm going to do this many, many times, covering the maybe 10,000 times in this case. And I'm going to apply the same strategy, so I'm going to keep the top 25%. Yes, XL.
Out of curiosity, did you set that the, I don't remember if it was before the end, the middle part goes from top to bottom, so there's no way that an electron can go from right to left or from left to right without encountering that change in battery. Is that something that you set as a constraint, or is this something that emerges from your simulation?
I'm not sure I understand the question. You said something about top, bottom, and right, left?
So there's different colors, right? There's N and P.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And there's no, it creates a, however the shape is,
yes.
It goes from top to bottom. So that there's no way.
Well, the electrons would be moving from left to right in the material.
Yeah, and so there's no way that it could go like up to avoid that part, that change.
Well, it's all coherent, so it's going to reflect and transmit essentially everywhere in that device. So I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So for the more sophisticated strategy, I'm going to use the same. Same strategy for optimizing the devices. So I'm going to select the top 25%, and then I'm going to mutate the rest of the 75% of the population. But instead of mutating now the points that represent the polygons in the structure, I'm just going to mutate the weights in our ANN policy. So I'm going to generate a matrix of random numbers that has the same dimension as the weights that would be in the neural network, and then I'm going to multiply that by the same alpha value to tweak the weights in the neural network. So to actually test that this should be working properly, so instead of looking at currents initially, we asked the question, you know, can we have half N, half P using this strategy? And you can see that very quickly we actually jump up to around 0.5 when we come from the bottom, and just above 0.5 when we come from the top, and that's because we actually have we have probabilities associated with N and P, and we're not actually, so we have to draw a random number, which is why we don't get exactly 0.5 in that case. And then we asked again, can we do maybe 0.3 and 0.7 for the fraction of P and N dope sites in our system? And again, we converge very quickly using this strategy. So then once we were satisfied with that, we then looked at the currents using this, and we came up with this device here. So this is the device that we found as an optima for this problem. And you can see again that it converges very, very quickly. And we don't have this problem anymore where we're stuck in a local minima where we're optimizing K prime over K or vice versa. It's actually being optimized both K and K prime simultaneously, which is really good. And again, we're above 90% purity when we look at that as a function of the generation. And additionally, we find that the currents are an order of magnitude higher than a previous strategy, which is great. So this is great. We have this structure here, so we can go to a lab and say, you know, generate this structure, and we can actually do testing. But what we'll find here, if we look closely here, so I've highlighted some of the points here, where we have one site that's N-doped and everything around it is P-doped. Obviously, in the lab, this would be very difficult to do. So in this picture here, where they have a gate voltage applied, you can see that we can't just modify one site at a time. We have to modify a neighborhood of sites if we're applying a gate voltage. So in light of this, we did image filtering during the design process. So we did we applied Gaussian blurring, and then also did some other image techniques to basically make these the end doped area is a bit larger, so we can actually apply gate voltages or design gate voltage devices to be applied onto these devices. And when we do that, we actually get better results. So again, the optimization function actually, it converges very, very quickly. So this is after like one or two generations, we actually find an optimal structure in this case. And you can see for up to 40 generations that we have both K and K prime currents being, they're improving together, but then we find a local minima again after generation 40 where the K prime is actually being optimized over the K. So we should, moving forward, try and introduce something into our objective function that kind of rids this this effect where we're optimizing one current over the other. And again, if we look at the currents, we can see that we're an order of magnitude higher than our previous strategy. Okay, so to summarize, when you're doing electron transport calculations for ballistic transport, you basically want to treat it as a particle passing through a finite barrier. I was able to search for structures by pairing transport calculations with GAs, and this was done with minimal effort, given that there's already packages that exist for electron transport in Python, and it's actually quite easy to implement a GA in Python as well, so it was quite easy to bring the packages together. So I found that the polygon strategy for splitting valley currents yields high purities, but gets stuck in a local minima, like I said, where we're optimizing one valley current over the other, and it produces devices with low currents. But the ANN policy for splitting valley currents yields high purities. It somewhat gets rid of this local minima, and has an order of magnitude higher currents. And that's all I have. So thank you very much.
So I noticed you did not discuss crossover at all in the genetic algorithms.
Yeah, so essentially it's not really a GA, it's kind of like a glorified random search.
Right.
But we do have plans to try and introduce crossover to see the overall development of a generation rather than just a random search.
Yeah, so for the polygons, I imagine that's sort of easier to maybe define intersections.
Yeah, you can kind of average over the polygons, right, or something like that. Yeah, that's right.
But you're planning to look.
Yeah, so this is implemented, but we haven't really studied the dynamics of the GA quite yet.
So when you have those fractal patterns, is the current still ballistic?
Sorry, the fractal patterns?
Fractal pattern, like these kind of regions. Is the ballistic current treatment still well-defined? Because if you look at the honeycomb about the nanometer.
Yeah, that's right. You kind of do get somewhat of a fractal pattern. I didn't notice that actually.
Or even in the late, after you image fitted, the structure, the endoped structure is also small enough that the ballistic fitment might not.
I'm not sure I understand your question. The length scales are still
okay,
small enough so that ballistic transport is definitely valid.
Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't matter about the PRN doping for the length scales. It's the ballistic transport calculations are still valid for these length scales. Yeah.
Just building off of what he was saying, is there any potential for scattering off a transition from P to N?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
So you have all these small length scale transitions from P to N.
Yeah.
Is there any potential for scattering off of those transitions?
Scattering is probably not the right terminology to use. It'd be like reflecting or transmitting through that. So in previous work, they found when you like add N doping, then usually K prime is actually reflected off of it back.
Okay.
But K currents actually are transmitted through it.
But does that impede the transport anyway? Can that contribute to it?
I mean, we're still in the regime where it's not diffusive transport, so yeah.
Thanks.
No problem.